The separation between science and human values is an illusion.
Where did we come from?
This is the first self-replicating species on the planet.
Future Proof. Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag Science Rising.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk 106 to 108 FM. I'm Jonathan McRae, and this is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. If you'd like to contact us, you can email us at science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter or Facebook. We're at Newstalk Science. Now, coming up on this week's show, we'll be shattering the myth that mathematics is a pursuit which is detached from the real world, as we find out how mathematicians are applying their skills to answer everyday questions and help us to perform better at everything from gambling to surgery. But first, as always, to discuss the week's science news, I'm joined in studio by Dr. Laura Dungan and Ian Brunswick from the Science Gallery. How are you both?
Very well, thank you.
How are you, Jonathan?
Ian, what's going on in the Science Gallery?
We've got lots going on. Next weekend, we have a big late event for the Festival of Curiosity that's called For Your Eyes Only.
Oh, yeah.
That's on Friday. That'll be good fun. I can't tell you anything more about it.
Oh.
Well, I actually could. I mean, there's lots going on.
Oh, you've got me. Tell them about me.
You're doing an
tell
event
them about
with
me.
Us. Yeah.
I'm there.
What are you doing?
On Wednesday.
Wednesday.
What are you doing?
You're like, no, you're Tuesday.
Don't make me when I'm not sure. No, it's going to be great. It's funny.
Do
it's
you
a
know what you're
I
doing?
I do. I like to research things just before they happen so that I don't forget when the event actually... It is going to be great, though. Please help me out here.
It's a comedy. It's a recording of a comedy podcast that's about...
It's Level Up Human.
Level Up Human.
Oh, okay. That's what I said.
So the guy who makes this program has also been a guest on this show. His name's Simon Watt. Very funny. Biologist, evolutionary biologist by trade, and he set up this new podcast. It's called Level Up Human. It's very good. Check it out on iTunes. You can find it on whatever podcast player you have. I'm plugging it too much. We are in competition with these guys.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's have a look at our first story. That is fantastic. The Pixies, who I saw, they were doing something in Marley Park. It was a sort of a, they were kind of a, they were warm up. And for the Pixies to be warm up, it was just kind of weird. But they played in Ivy Gardens on Thursday and they were phenomenal.
They did?
Yeah, they did.
Oh, amazing. Okay.
And this is about a window into the mind. So we can find where the mind is. See the link?
Yes, that was very... Oh,
where is my mind?
Okay, I got you.
It's right there in front of you.
I was a little slow on that one. So this is new research that's come from a big, huge, multidisciplinary group. So it's run by a guy called Guillermo Aguilar, who's in Mexico. And they've just published two papers that have come out at a similar time. And it's about literally a transparent window that they put in place of part of your skull so that they can still see into your brain and shoot in a laser. Which sounds very high tech, but it's very, very cool. So this
is like a window on your head.
Yeah. So what people often have to do, now this isn't the only way of treating this. So in case someone's like, that's not the only way of treating it. Sometimes to treat cancer in the brain or metastases from other parts that cause cancer in the brain, surgeons have to go in and remove a part of the skull to make a window. And what you can do is either put it straight back after you've done it, or you can stick it in the freezer and hope that you can put it back in the future. Neither one is ideal. It leaves open. I know.
Gross.
It's not great. It's either a craniotomy or a craniectomy, depending on whether you take it out forever. And if you take it out, and obviously even if you don't, you leave a lot of options for bacteria. And also it's a very serious surgery. So what they've done is they've created this yttria stabilized zirconia. So people have heard of, say, cubic zirconia, which is the kind of fake diamonds. This is a similar sort of thing, but they use it to make hip replacements. And it's a sort of a ceramic. And they've basically made a window out of it. So they take out the bit of the skull and they replace it with this. And what they've just proven, the two papers that they've just shown, is one, it doesn't get rejected by the human body.
Okay.
Well, actually by the animal body. They haven't put it into humans yet. And the second thing they've proven is that because it's transparent, they can fire a laser through and kill bacteria that might be causing an infection, because one of the most important causes of infection is, they call it a nidus. So anything that you put in that's not human can create this biofilm of bacteria across it. It's really horrible. It's a really big source of infection. So because it's see-through and they can put a laser in, they can kill the bacteria. And then the whole point of this is that they can then use this to laser into the brain to destroy tumor tissue. If they want to treat.
That is so cool.
I know.
I'm
it's
really
like what they
gross.
Do with the eyes, you know, the LASIK, I think, or LASIK.
LASIK, yeah.
Yeah, that's how they do a laser. And basically, laser is amazing because you can have them burn away tissues at an exact point, and that's what they would hopefully do, but people would have little windows so that they wouldn't have to be going in and out of surgery. They could just go in and, well, I mean, I don't know, the possibilities are almost endless,
wow.
really.
Wow.
Yeah, it's so cool.
And obviously it's been investigated because it's better than taking a part of the brain,
yeah.
the skull off.
There is another way. They do it by burrowing a hole in the back of the skull, and it's a very small hole, and they put the lasers in, and then they use an MRI to see where the lasers are heating up and burning away. So it's not the only option, but it is a very interesting option.
Good God, you really feel for people who that is,
yeah.
you know, that's an actual surgery for them.
Mm.
Ian, your first story has to do with how certain monkeys picked up tools and when.
Well, exactly. And so we've known that certain primates have used tools and are effectively in the Stone Age in that regard. So we know that chimpanzees and macaques use tools. But there's this budding field called primate archaeology, because we have to find out how long have they been using tools. Did they use different kinds of tools in the past? Have they recently invented them? Have they copied them from humans? Probably not, actually. And do they pass them on in what way? So a new study's shown that Capuchin monkeys in Brazil look like they've been using tools.
Disc saws.
No, not discs, and not lasers either, which would be, yeah, I know. Somebody give these monkeys lasers. They are opening cashews the old school way with, you know, like basically little hammers, like, you know, the right rock to open these cashews. And the cool thing is, it's not just grab a rock that's nearby and smash it. The monkeys look around for a particular rock that's good and, you know, fits their hands right. And then they get one that they like. This is their cashew cracking nut, and they keep it. And they actually store it kind of at the bottom of fruit trees in these little neat pile. It's like they're chef knives, you know? And the good thing about that is, if you want to find where these old ones are from hundreds of years ago, you just have to look in the same spot, because they've been doing it the same way apparently for hundreds of years. And these researchers found old macaque cashew cracking tools under trees and carbon dated the cashew on them, and they've gotten back to 700 years. So at least 100 generations, because a Capuchin monkey's generation is about 7 years as opposed to ours, which is 25, about at least 100 generations have been using these tools. And they haven't changed much, which actually makes it much more likely that they weren't just invented then. They've been going on much longer. So they've been in the Stone Age for possibly thousands of years.
Somebody should introduce them to the NutriBullet.
Yeah, I know. I mean, they got to go. They haven't gone far past this. They've had this for
like
a long time.
I mean, really, 700 years.
Yeah, I'm actually a little disappointed. I wish they had said, like, and actually, in the last 50 years, they've made lots of tweaks on them, and, you know, they'll probably have Teslas in a few years.
Kind of a nut shake sort of thing.
Yeah, or drill.
You can do a lot with the NutriBullet. It's not just juices and smoothies.
Are you making commission? Is this what this is all about?
No. I just think it's a really good product, and it's available.
Well, I think it's probably likely they'll be using lasers within, you know, 50 years. That's what this points to.
Well, only if the window into the brain thing works. Otherwise, they know lasers aren't.
Well, the windows on the cashews.
Okay. Windows into the cashews.
Yeah.
Okay. Your second story, Lara, has to do with kids who suck their thumbs.
Yep. So this is a nice study that came out of New Zealand, the University of Otago. And they took information from children who were born in between 1972 and 1973. And they followed them and they researched them at the ages of 5, 7, 9 and 11 to ask their parents whether they sucked their thumbs and or bit their nails. And then at the age of 13 and 32, they assessed how many reacted to a skin prick test. I don't know if anyone ever has allergies, but what they do is they do this kind of little test on your skin, and they basically
scratch test, I think it's called.
Yeah, exactly. And they insert the allergen, and if you react, then it's likely you're allergic to it. And what they found was the children who did neither, about 49% of them had allergies. The children who did
49%?
Yeah, which I thought was mad. Now, this is an allergy.
Is that like an American allergy, or is it like a real
I hear now.
Allergy?
I hear.
Oh, I forgot. I actually forgot your
Oh, yes, yeah, sorry.
No, oops. But you know the way.
I mean, it's okay to be mean about Americans as long as there's not one in the studio. But it's a reaction to the skin test. I know it doesn't necessarily mean that if you consume whatever it is, you're going to die, but it is a reaction. If they had done either thumb sucking or nail biting, only 38% of them reacted. And if they'd done both, 31% reacted. And the concept is this.
How big a study is this?
1,037 children.
Is that what
it is? Wow, you knew that number right off the bat.
I know, she
right?
actually reads the papers before she talks about it.
Yeah. And it's basically the hygiene hypothesis, which you talk about all the time. The idea is that because the children are sucking their thumbs or biting their nails, they're having more exposure to different allergens and to different microbes, and that's making them more or less likely to have allergies to these same microbes or to different allergens because of the early exposure. This is the concept.
Is the over a thousand people enough? Is that a big enough study to be able to say that this actually does benefit?
It's not a great study. It's a fine study. I think it's an all right basis as maybe an early study, but I wouldn't start. You know, there's downsides to thumb sucking as well. Like if a child sucks his thumb beyond the age of 5, it can actually cause irreparable damage to the jaw and teeth.
Yeah.
So it's not actually a good thing, and it's not something you want to encourage your children to do. So I think it's, to be honest, it's not a wonderful study.
I got a bit grossed out by the by the kids who suck their thumbs, because when the thumb comes out, it's like swollen and red and really like clean. It looks like a different sort of appendage. It's a bit gross.
Oh God.
Our last story has to do with the common cold, and this it was an old wives' tale that, you know, you should wrap up well because otherwise you'll catch a cold.
Yep.
And then science proved it wrong, proved that wrong. That was a myth. And now science has to
come
cap in hand, tail between its legs, and say, sorry, mums and old wives, you were right.
Sorry, Matt, I'll take that jumper. Yeah. Okay, in fairness, they were a little bit right.
A little bit right.
Well, listen, more study is needed, okay?
Stop.
Some researchers from Yale have found pretty conclusive evidence and new evidence now that being cold does actually make you more susceptible to getting a cold. So if you get the rhinovirus is what they tested, but if you get a cold virus, one of the things your cells can do if they get
the
infected.
The rhinovirus, for people who aren't Ian and Lara, is a virus that's also known as the common cold.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so just in case, because people may not know that
a
rhinovirus.
So you get a cold and we're just, you know, 1,037, but I can't say rhinovirus. So you get this cold virus, and they gave it to I think they gave it to mouse cells. And what they looked at was if they were cold, you know, did they get the virus? Did they succumb to it? And if they weren't cold, what happened? An interesting defense is that when one cell gets the rhinovirus, it can do a thing called apoptosis. There we go. Where it's basically, it kills itself so that it doesn't spread the virus to other cells. And this defense is diminished when the cells are a little bit below their optimal temperature. So if you're cold, one of your cells may get this virus and it doesn't, you know, kill itself.
Apoptose.
Oh, that's and the other cells get it. So the infection spreads. It's not just that you're susceptible to it, but it actually spreads more quickly. So if you are cold, this is going to happen more rapidly, and you're gonna succumb to the common cold more likely. So actually do wear a scarf around your sort of neck, and you're probably going to be a little bit less likely to get a cold.
I've said it before and I'll say it again. Essentially, medical school is just telling you what the secret words that doctors use mean. That's it. There's no learning. They don't know anything. They just use these words. Oh, you seem to be...
But we fool most people.
You have lack of pseudocremosis.
Or flat seven-upitis.
All right. Dr. Lara Duggan, Ian Brunswick, thank you as always. Now, the house always wins. It's a saying we're all familiar with. And yet, somehow it doesn't stop us gambling in huge numbers, does it? The search for the perfect bet, a way of finally stacking the odds in your favour, is something of a fool's errand, and yet it's a pursuit that's had a profound impact on science and mathematics. So is there a perfect bet? And if gambling has informed science, can science return the favour and help the gambler to find it? Adam Kucharski is a lecturer in mathematical modelling in the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. He's also author of The Perfect Bet. He joins us now. Hi, Adam. How are you?
Hi, I'm good, thank you.
Are you a gambling man, Adam?
From time to time. I think really it's a matter of finding a game that you can win.
Oh, well, then that's why I do not gamble. Here's my theory about gamblers, right? I think gamblers are separated into two types of people, and it all goes down to the very first time they laid a bet. If they won or broke even on the first time they went on a gambling experience, they go, oh, this is great. If they lose, like I did, they go, what was the point of that? I just lost my money. This is fun. And so I think that experience is what defines whether or not people are going to be gamblers or not. And I'm not a gambler. I can go into a casino and spend the whole night there and I'll come back exactly with the same amount of money I had with me every time.
I think that's really interesting. Actually, there is that definite emotional side. And I think there's a lot of psychology in terms of how we approach risk. And I think that's one of the reasons that these games have appealed to scientists so much, because whether you win the first time or you lose the first time, if you've got that interest in how chance works, you really want to be able to unpick actually what the optimal thing to do. And my background's in maths. I think I've always had an interest in testing out what might work and really what the fundamentals are behind these kind of games and how they can be tackled.
So is this something you've tried? Have you tried to beat the house using maths?
There's a few times over the years. So actually one of the things that happened when I was a student years ago was there was a big expansion in online betting in the UK, for example. It was around 2006. And what it meant is if you played a game like blackjack, if you play the optimal mathematical strategy, you'll still lose money. You'll lose about 0.5% per hand. So,
right.
You know, in other words, if you place £100, you'd expect to lose around 50p. But what was happening is that the casinos to drum up support were offering these big sign-up bonuses. So in fact, you could play a losing game for long enough and they would subsidize your losses to the point that you'd come out on top. I think there's a number of examples like that of people from blackjack to lotteries looking at where these loopholes exist and finding ways to actually convert a game that's usually a losing bet into something that you can make money on.
I see. Okay. So, yeah. So, ordinarily, the game is always rigged that you'd lose. But with these sort of like special days where the, you know, the bookies are trying to get you in, or that, or these sort of extra odds that they give you, tip it in your favor.
Exactly. And there was a really interesting story a few years back about some MIT students. So it started with a college project, a maths project, and they were looking at which lotteries were profitable. And the project obviously expanded, as these things do. And eventually they realized that there was one lottery where essentially they hadn't had many winners. And to try and counter this, because if you get rollovers for a year, you know, there's no publicity and everyone gets a bit fed up with this. Mm. What they did as a lottery was, if it reached a certain point, would have a roll down effect. So the prizes from the jackpot would roll down to all the other prize tiers. And when these students analyzed the lottery, they realized that basically what's happening is the ticket cost $2 to buy, but there was $2.30 waiting in prize money in those roll down weeks. So if you plan the right strategy to buy up enough tickets, essentially, you know, you were being sold a ticket for $2 that was worth $2.30.
I see. And that, if you do enough of it, can turn out to be quite significant. Is this a mathematical approach to gambling? Presumably it's quite old, because gambling has been around probably since the beginning of civilization. So this idea of trying to use maths to win money is probably not new.
Exactly. It goes back all the way to the 16th century. And what's really interesting is the ideas haven't just gone one way. So as you mentioned, a lot of people have tried to use maths to understand odds better and find edges. But it's also been the case that a lot of betting games have inspired new areas of maths and science. So one example from 16th century Italy was a guy who did a lot of gambling and developed a lot of the basic ideas of probability. Because if you can imagine, there was actually a time where there was no real concept of how likely something was. If you roll two dice and two sixes come up, there's no way to actually quantify how likely that event is. And a lot of these early ideas around probability and things that we use quite often in terms of how we measure the value of something really came from this industry. And actually, statistics as well, a large amount of that in terms of how we recognize randomness. If you see a series of events, trying to measure whether that's a coincidence or not, and that's something that's obviously incredibly important in clinical vaccine trials and this sort of thing, again, originated with people studying casino games.
Yeah, like Galileo looked at this sort of question, didn't he? And how did he find an answer to it?
So he was looking again at some of these initial dice games around these kind of odds. And actually, if you go through history, it seems that a lot of the big names in science, I think Kepler as well had a go at it.
Really?
And I found research in the book, Alan Turing had an unpublished paper on poker. I think he couldn't quite work out the solution, but you've got pages of him playing around with gambling ideas. So huh. I think a lot of these people, as a almost side hobby, were looking at these questions around gambling and trying to test out their ideas about luck.
And so a lot of the time, you know, science informs us about other things such as gambling. Can gambling teach us anything about science or mathematics?
I think there's a few interesting things that have come out of it. I mean, one of the biggest fields potentially is game theory. So this was obviously in A Beautiful Mind made famous, this idea of when you're making decisions against other people, you can't focus on what you're doing. You have to anticipate what they might do and how they might react to your decisions and this trade-off between the two. And the earliest research on this by a mathematician called John von Neumann was inspired by poker. And he came up with a very simplified version of the game. And what was really interesting is he showed that mathematically, the optimal thing to do was to bluff in some situations. Until that point, I think gamblers had obviously been trying to deceive each other, but it was always seen as a very human trait. Mm. And what was actually emerging here was that it is not a feature of human psychology. It's actually the mathematically optimal thing to do. So in games like poker and these negotiation bargaining situations, in a lot of these cases, it is actually a good idea to try and deceive your opponent. And that's just the mathematics rather than the sort of, you know, human behavior.
How has gambling affected probability theory? Or is there a relationship in that? Like, was mathematics always ahead of gambling, or has gambling taught us anything about statistics and probability that we didn't know before?
I think in many cases, the two have gone hand in hand, that it's been people with a mathematical inclination looking at these games that have developed the theory to try and beat them, and then subsequent people have built on them. This is one case of a French writer who had a question about betting and wrote a letter to his mathematician friend saying, you know, I can't solve this problem. It was to do with, say you're flipping a coin, say you and me are playing a coin flipping game, and the first person to reach a certain number wins, but we don't we get interrupted halfway through and one of us is ahead, how do you share the money? And that was the question he was really interested in, but he just couldn't get anywhere. And actually he sent it off to these mathematicians and they derived this whole theory about how much a game is worth, which actually is fundamental from everything kind of finance into a lot of the prediction work you see in other areas of science, trying to estimate what the expected outcome will be in a particular situation. So I think really gambling's always been there as a source of inspiration for these people.
This area of probability and gambling and so on, it sort of helped us in many ways, like in DNA sequencing, particle physics, and in even Bayesian mathematics, that's allowed us to find things that we could never find in a million years.
Exactly. And a lot of the techniques actually that we use, so I work on disease outbreak analysis. So it's really kind of applying these ideas of probability to public health. And one of the tools we use a lot is known as the Monte Carlo method, which by its name alone probably hints at its origins, and actually came from a mathematician who was studying card games and realized that a lot of these very difficult problems that mathematically you just simply can't write down all the equations and solve them just because too many combinations to deal with. He decided that what was much easier is just to try it a few times. So rather than trying to work out all the combinations of the cards, actually just lay out some card formations and see what happens. And very similar techniques are now being used in science, where there's these quite difficult probability problems which are being solved by simulation and using these Monte Carlo methods to actually just simulate lots of random events and see what happens. And from that, you can emerge conclusions and estimates about what's going on.
Is that what's driving AI?
There's a few different features. I think certainly the ability to use these machine learning approaches have been very valuable. One of the things I found remarkable researching the book is that a lot of these teams who've come up with these brilliant poker bots, by their own admission, aren't actually very good at poker themselves. So you've got people who aren't particularly good at poker creating the world's best poker players. And the reason for that is that a lot of the early attempts to build poker programs or what's known as rule-based approaches. So in other words, the creator just told their bot exactly what to do. In this situation, you do this, in this situation, you do that.
Yeah.
And that meant the bot was only as good as its creator, essentially. And what the really successful teams are doing is they're almost embracing their ignorance. They know they're not good at poker, so they're going to tell the bot to go out and learn. And it's getting these programs to play billions and billions of games and really using this machine learning approaches so that the bot can develop far beyond what their creators are capable of. And the recent example, you know, AlphaGo, the Google software that recently triumphed at Go, was another nice illustration of how these machine learning techniques can learn to play these games which traditionally humans have dominated at.
Is there a particular game that lends itself particularly well to prediction through mathematics? Is there a game, whether it's, you know, betting on horse races, or is it the closed systems? Or is it the much more anything could happen systems that lend themselves to better prediction?
In terms of prediction, the games which are almost cleaner from a statistical point of view, the easiest ones. You think of a game like baseball, where you've got a pitcher and a batter, it's these one-on-one matchups. You haven't got a lot of other processes going on. And similarly, a lot of the successful syndicates working on horse races in Hong Kong, whereas there you've got one or two tracks generally where races are being held. You've got a small number of horses racing against each other again and again. So it's almost as if you were going to design an experiment to look at horse racing, that's pretty much how you design it, because
right.
You haven't got all these variables kicking around. You've got this kind of fixed, almost laboratory to look at. What's much harder to predict is team sports, things like football, where there's a huge number of interactions and players. And it's not always clear what contribution each person is making. Sometimes you'll see a player who's incredibly important to the team, but not actually doing anything you can obviously measure.
Mm.
And as well, if you've got low scoring games, obviously in a football match, you know, in some situations that one goal is potentially the only important event in the whole game.
Yes, the jeopardy is so high and the likelihood of something happening is pretty high that it's impossible to predict.
Exactly. And for a long time, people actually analysing football basically concluded the results were down to chance. It wasn't something that you could reliably predict. And it's only in recent years that people have expanded and got more data and more computational power to actually be able to untangle all of those interactions to try and work out what's important in predicting who's going to win.
This really brings to mind that movie Moneyball about the Ivy League graduate Peter Brand, who was played by Jonah Hill in the film, where he looked purely at stats to improve the baseball team. I can't remember who it was at the time. Was it Oakland A's or something? And he looked at, okay, we don't need the best players in the world. We need the best players for these particular positions, and let's have a look at their stats. Is that in the same realm, this idea? Because in America, they put numbers on everything, don't they? Does that make it really easy for people to make decisions because they've got so much information to hand?
I think Moneyball is obviously a fantastic story, and it's one of the reasons that America's been so far ahead almost of other areas is that obsession almost with statistics in sports. And again, because baseball, because you can divide the roles into very specific actions, that is something that's much easier to measure. But it's interesting, actually, in recent years, pretty much all the Premiership teams now employ statisticians to go through data and analytics. And I think there's a bit of a, obviously, a cultural barrier that you've got the old guard who don't want to see.
Yeah, they have a gut feeling. Yeah, I mean, it's essentially Moneyball playing itself out in real life in the Premiership. And yet, even though there's a perfect example of how and why this works across the water and made into a big Hollywood movie, you can totally see people like cut from the same cloth as Brian Clough, you know, just basically going, no.
Exactly. And I think one of the, both in sport and I guess just in life, the challenges from a psychological point of view is often you can do the correct thing from a prediction point of view or a statistical point of view and not get the outcome you want, you know, in a game of poker or any kind of risk situation that can happen. And likewise, you can make potentially a bad decision and get lucky and get the correct result. And I think in games like football, where often it's quite difficult to untangle the role of skill and the role of luck, particularly if you're evaluating how good players are, I think that's something that can potentially come through, that you can have players who get lucky and people take credit for them being skillful, or players who actually fundamentally are much better, but you know, the goal didn't go in or this sort of thing. And I think it's, especially in tournaments where it's a much shorter format, those lucky events in those low scoring kind of games can be incredibly important and skew people's belief about how useful analytics can be.
Right. I suppose the takeaway message is, even if we put a number on every individual information point, because the numbers start to get into the billions of trillions in terms of possibilities, that even with really, really supercomputers, you can't predict outcomes successfully all the time.
Exactly. And a few of the syndicates, I mean, one of them I talked to actually said to me that, you know, there's no such thing as a magic formula. There's nothing that's going to tell you exactly what's going to happen with a football game. I think really the challenge from a betting point of view and from a team management point of view is really just to be better than the other guys. You know, you're never going to get it perfect all of the time. But I think in sport and in gambling, as long as you're better than the other guy, that's what's important.
Key learning is be better than the team that's on the pitch. That does sound like something Brian Clough would say. Brilliant. Listen, thank you so much. Adam Kucharski, lecturer in mathematical modelling at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and author of The Perfect Bet. Thanks very much for coming on the programme.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Now, we've already heard about how maths can be applied to the world of gambling, but that's probably not that surprising, seeing as gambling is just numbers. But how can a mathematician help when it comes to the more hands-on methods of the surgeon or the forensic scientist? Well, biomechanics is a rapidly growing field, and it's proving that if you need to know how best to conduct surgery, whether a stabbing was intentional or where a brain tumour is, you might just be better off speaking to a mathematician. And here we are, where you've got Professor Michel Destrade in studio. He's the established Professor of Applied Mathematics at NUI Galway. Welcome to the programme, Michel. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks, Jonathan. Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan.
Well, thanks very much. So your work is really interesting because essentially you are trying to find out the best way to cut up a human body.
That's right. That's the type of question a surgeon might ask themselves when they are faced with a procedure. How should they cut it open? Should they cut that way, this way? Does it matter? Turns out it does. That's because our skin is stretched in our body, and it's stretched in different directions at different locations. And depending how you cut compared to those directions, you will end up having either a neat scar or a bumpy, unsightly scar. And most surgeons pay attention to that. They want to make sure you're going to have a neat scar that will heal quickly and as neatly as possible.
Because it's not just cosmetics, is it? The scar that's left. It's not just that it's a small, neat scar as opposed to something that looks like, you know, you've
yes,
been
that
to
matters
Dr.
on the face, say, for instance, or exposed parts. But it also matters in other location. If you have a huge surgery, a large incision, you want it to heal as quickly as possible.
Yeah,
to avoid the risk of infection.
And bigger scar, because scar tissue is different from unscarred or healthy tissue, isn't that right? The actual structure of it is different, and so it doesn't behave in the same way. So you want a smaller scar, because the more healthy tissue you have, the better.
True. And also, yeah, it's bumpier and stiffer. And also, if you're still growing, say if you have a surgery when you're young, then if the scar is not well oriented, then it might just spread. Say, for instance, you have a mole removed on your torso, and that skin is thin and will stretch a lot as you grow. That might lead to a really large area of scar tissue.
Okay. So this is not a problem I'd really thought about, you know, what the best way is to cut open a body. And, you know, I'd say most people, besides psychopaths and surgeons, probably haven't really thought about it either. But you have come up with a really interesting way of approaching this problem, because if you cut in the right way, it's a small scar. But if you cut in the wrong direction, it can be a big scar. How do we know which way our skin is going? Because it's different for everyone, isn't it?
Yes. So like I say, it's important to know those directions where the skin is stretched. Because if you are cutting perpendicular to those directions, then the scar will just gape open. And then even if stitch it back up, there will still be, you know, a tug at the site, and that will require nutrients to come, and that will lead to a bumpy scar. So finding these directions is, or knowing those directions, is a big issue for surgeons. So usually they rely on anatomy maps. And if you look in the anatomy books, you will find those lines for men and those lines for women, and that's the only distinction there is. When really, it might change from one person to another according to other factors. For instance, your body mass index, your age, your health status, your ethnicity, all sorts of factors will change the orientation of those lines.
Your ethnicity determines the direction of your tissue, really?
The direction of tension in the skin.
Oh, yes. Tension in the skin. Okay.
There are differences.
So give an example of how these things would differ. So
say maybe you become obese, or say you are pregnant, your skin is going to be stretched.
Yeah.
And it's likely that the orientation of those lines is going to be different as it was before you were pregnant, for instance.
So to try and figure out the direction of the stretch, you've used sound.
So yes, our point of view is that we could maybe help surgeons make a decision on how to best cut open a body of one person at a given location. And to do that, we use sound waves. So we just launch sound waves in the skin and try to figure out in which direction they go at their fastest.
And so if it travels really fast, that means it's really, really tight?
That was the idea. And you could think of, for instance, say a guitar string that you are making tauter. It will vibrate faster. So that you see that there's a link between how fast something vibrates or moves and how tight it is. And so that was the mathematical hypothesis, was that the sound wave would go at its fastest along the direction of the stretch. But that was just a hypothesis, of course. We had to test it in the lab.
So the idea is you have the side of the scar, and then you've got a sort of a microphone set somewhere near the scar, and then you tap the scar?
Basically, yes. It's a very simple device that has two probes, one that taps the skin and another one that picks up the signal a bit further away.
And you stopwatch it and you see if it's really fast.
You know the distance between the two probes, and then you know how fast the sound travels.
Okay. So how did you test this? Because presumably you can't just do this on people. It'd be slightly unethical to start working on people's scars and just prodding them with probes. How did you go about
this? Well, the probe is non-invasive. I just put it on your skin. So we did it on ourselves. So we gave ourselves ethical approval, I guess. Huh. But like I was saying, there was this hypothesis that the wave will travel, the sound will travel at its fastest. And to test it, we used dead animals that we obtained from the UCD School of Veterinary Science. We found the direction of fastest sound, and then at that site we cut out a circle of skin, a disc, perfect disc, and then we watch as the disc started elongating, because remember that the skin is stretched, so the circle is going to turn into an ellipse, and sure enough the ellipse was aligned with that direction we'd found. So that was the proof of concept, that the sound device was telling you the direction of stretch in the skin at the given spot.
Okay, so there is huge, obviously, medical applications for this. Are there other applications that I haven't thought of for this, knowing where the tension is in a body?
Yes, we're also hoping to be able to determine the level of tension, saying the skin is under so much force at this spot or at another spot. And that's very important for surgeons who do reconstructive surgery. They want to know maybe if they're going to graft something, or they're going to expand your skin in another location so then they can graft it into the site where they want to suture it in. And they want to know what's the level of tension there.
Right.
Because okay. it might, if there's too much of a differential, it might be that the graft is going to rupture, for instance. So they want to make sure that the graft they're putting is the right shape and is not going to rupture once they put it in that site.
There's probably an application for this. I mean, I was joking about psychopaths earlier, but presumably in crime, there's an application for knowing what happens when you cut a body and how it affects the body. Would that be useful
Absolutely,
in helping
yeah.
helping criminal cases?
In fact, that's how I got interested in the mechanics of the skin in the first place, is that the first project was about forensics. We were approached by Professor Mary Cassidy and Dr. Mike Curtis from the State Pathologist's Office. And at the time, I was in UCD's School of Mechanical Engineering. And they were asking us, can you help us determine the level of force that's required to puncture the skin, the human skin?
They didn't know that?
It's not known, no. It's not known in a scientific way. They often ask that question at trials, right?
Right.
They ask, well, what was the level of force? Because the defendant would say, oh, it was a running
he just walked,
scenario.
He walked into me yeah. knife.
Exactly.
Mate.
Wanted to give him a hug and he fell onto the knife.
He slipped
and, went
and fell
through his,
and stabbed himself five
yes.
times. Yeah.
So then the judge turns to the forensic expert and says, is that possible? Can a knife just go through? And what was the level of force used in this assault? And they have to give terms that make sense to them but might be a bit vague to a jury. Terms like mild or moderate or severe. That's the only type of description they can give.
Right, okay.
So, that's so not moderate to you, you might go, oh, maybe that's not
moderate's not
much.
So bad.
Yes,
yeah.
But maybe it involves...
I wouldn't mind being moderately stabbed.
Exactly. But maybe it involves having to go through cartilage and, you know, breaking a bone on the way. So they're very frustrated by this level of uncertainty.
Okay, so the state pathologist came to you to kind of say, look, we want to know what level of force is required to puncture the skin. Is it possible that someone just brushed into someone and stabbed them, or would they have actually have to direct it? And you found a metric for that, did you?
So We started up a PhD project. So I was working with Professor Michael Gilchrist in UCD, and we recruited Ashley Niani, a brilliant student who managed to do experiments first on pig skin and then also on human skin in France, trying to determine the level of force it takes to puncture a human skin.
And is it a lot or?
Turns out it's pretty low. If you're talking about just naked skin, doesn't take that much force,
really?
Say 10 to 20 newtons. So that would be the equivalent of 1 kilo or 2 kilos of sugar put on your skin.
Oh, wow.
Of course,
is that all?
But that's for a pointy knife.
Pointy knife.
And a given knife.
Okay.
If it's a screwdriver, maybe it takes 30 to 50.
Like, how does anyone ever get a conviction with all these things? So that's really interesting. But you've sort of applied this mathematical idea, kind of taking maths and looking at biomechanics and so on, to lots of different problems. And one of them was looking at the structure of the brain and again, trying to find a tumor in a brain. Can you tell us a little bit about that sort of research?
Yes. The main question I wanted to answer is, how soft in the head are we, really? Because it's an expression I understood really quickly when I learned English.
Right.
When people say, oh, he's a bit soft in the head, you know what they mean.
Yeah.
But I was wondering, how soft in
Did
the
they
head?
Have that in French? That
no,
expression?
We don't
no,
have that.
No.
But it's easy to understand for a foreigner.
Yeah.
But the truth is, how soft is brain matter? What do you think, Jonathan? Rubber?
No, it's got to be like jelly, right? It's very soft and good. I've held a brain. Although
You've
it seems
brain,
quite, it
yes.
seems, maybe that's just because it's slimy on the outside, but it does feel sort of soft.
Is it soft.
Is it very soft?
It is very soft, yes.
Okay.
In the end, we use the same principle. We launch sound waves through the brain and we watch them travel to an ultrasound image and measure their speed. And then we did the same for gelatin. So it was a 5% gelatin solution. 5% gelatin, 95% water. So it's one of the softest things I can think of. And still, the speed was slower in the brain than in the gelatin,
wow.
indicating that the brain was softer
so
than
if
the
you,
gelatin.
So if I didn't have a skull, you could just push your finger
True.
Straight through. Yeah.
Well, there's the meningites, the dura mater, so membrane, and then there's the skull.
So the membrane is like a little plastic bag or whatever.
Yes, and
so
that's very tough.
Is it?
Very hard to cut and to penetrate.
Oh, is it? Okay.
And it holds your brain. But say you were in an impact or you had a repeated injury or maybe you were exposed to a blast explosion, then there could be movement inside the envelope.
Okay.
And that's bad news. It could be that your neurons... your axons, you know, those channels of information in your brain, they get stretched and that they might even break. And then that's traumatic brain injury.
Because you were talking about brain injuries and I was thinking there about tumors. Do tumors, Are they the same? Do they change the actual tissue?
That's also something very interesting. Once I was talking to a neurosurgeon in the John Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford, asking him, how does he know which is the diseased tissue as opposed to the healthy tissue when he's faced with a brain that he wants to operate on, right? So typically, if you have a tumor in your brain, they just do a trepanation. They take out a piece of your skull. They cut out the dura mater. They expose the brain. And they know the tumor is in this area, but where is it exactly? And I was asking him,
You're saying when someone does a brain operation, they know the tumor is in sort of an area. Can they not map it?
So they know exactly where it is from an MRI scan.
Okay.
And so now for the operation, they put you in a device that will just recreate exactly locate exactly where the tumor is. So then the surgeon is going to remove a part of the skull above that area. But what happens then when you take out a part of the skull? The brain shifts a little bit. That's what they call it, brain shifts. It sort of expands a little bit because it was a bit compressed in your skull.
Okay.
And then the contours are a bit off now compared to what you had in your picture.
Oh, no way.
You can't do an MRI anymore because you're operating.
Yeah.
And MRI is long acquisition time.
Yeah.
So I say, well, how do you do it then? Because somehow I thought maybe the tumor looks different. Maybe it's, you know, black and the rest is white.
No.
But you say, no, it looks exactly the same.
Huh?
Yes.
So how do they do it?
And they say, oh, you just poke at it. We just use our finger. Well, they have gloves on, right? But they use their finger. They do palpation. I don't want to trivialize it. Palpation is a proper
diagnosis
tool. But that's what they do. They just use their fingers to figure out which part is stiff. And they know that's the tumor as opposed to which part is soft. And they know that's healthy tissue.
And then they
stop there.
So they just, what, they just tap and suck?
Yes. So, yeah, to remove a tumor, brain is so soft that naively I thought they were using scalpels maybe, but no, it's so soft that they actually use a sort of aspiration pipette, slurping device.
Like a dentist's sucker.
Exactly, yes. And just suck out cells like this. And another doctor I was talking to, Nick DePennington, he told me that he listens to the sound of this slurping device. And he knows that if the pitch changes, he knows that he's hitting the healthy part and it stops. So,
what do you mean? Like he's going, and if it goes,
he knows,
that's healthy tissue. You're kidding.
So it's pretty crude tools, right? Either palpation or either listening to the.
God.
But that's the top of neurosurgery at the moment for cancerous brain tumors.
So we were just talking about how you were using sort of sound to determine the nature of the brain. Could surgeons use sound to figure out where the tumor is? I know you have a device for testing the scar, the tissue direction. Can you do that for a brain? Because it sounds like they would really need that. I mean, it sounds more important, right?
There exists already a medical device that propagates sound waves in soft tissues. It's only a few years old. It's used mostly for breast cancer or for liver, for instance. But I'm hoping to use it on the human brain. And I'm hoping that it will catch this difference in stiffness and put a number on how stiff the tumor is as opposed to a healthy tissue. That's what I'm hoping to do. As you can imagine, it's going to be difficult and it's going to require a lot of ethical approval and approaching neurosurgeons to do this.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping to be able to give them a number in the end and say, this is not good and this is healthy.
Because it all comes down to a number. So that number is the distance or the time it takes, and that number will tell you this is healthy tissue or this is not healthy tissue, and this is where you cut.
So because it's linked to stiffness. And so in the end, I'd be able to put the number of what they're feeling with their fingers or what they're hearing in the change of pitch. I'd be able to quantify this.
And with the number, you can create a tool like a beeping noise that when
something
they get...
Something would be more accurate, I guess.
Really interesting stuff. Professor Michelle Destrade, established professor of applied mathematics at NUI Galway. Thanks very much for your time.
Okay.
So if you have any thoughts or questions about what you've just heard, you can find us on Twitter at NewsTalkScience or email us science@newstalk.com. Last week, we had a very, very interesting and terrifying show all about DARPA, the defense agency's research arm in the United States. We spoke to Annie Jacobson, who wrote a book called The Pentagon's Brain, an Uncensored History of DARPA. She told us some really scary things about how this organization is basically coming up with really creepy ways of killing people, from hijacking people's brains to coming up with very weird sorts of weapons. Loads of you got in touch about it. Lynn says, I got the heebie-jeebies after listening to that. Caroline said, love the show, thought it was amazing. Des said, anyone interested in this has to listen to the interview. And lots of other lovely texts from Katrina, Gerald, Ryan. Kevin says, this is a very worrying piece on DARPA today. Do Congress look into them? Well, Kevin, Congress pays for them. This is from DARPA's own website. DARPA could not fulfill its mission of developing breakthrough technologies for national security without consistent broad support from Congress. They are the people who are funded by Congress, which is fantastic. If you haven't listened to that episode, do listen back. It's just one podcast ago, and holy moly, I did feel a lot like Mel Gibson in Conspiracy Theory during it. I was going, nah, this can't be right. But Annie Jacobson's reputation as a reporter is pretty well established. Okay, that's it from us for this week. I do hope you enjoyed the show. You can listen to previous podcasts on iTunes or newstalk.com in the podcast section. The Newstalk app has gotten a lot better, by the way, so if you used to use it, it's gotten much better, so check that out. And click subscribe, rate, we really appreciate that sort of stuff. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, who was researching, and Stephen Jordan, who was producing. We will talk to you next time, or you can catch the show live every Saturday from 12 p.m. Irish time. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof, proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. #ScienceRising.